The Diagnosis and Management of Anxiety in Children, presented by Barbara J. Howard, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics, Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, Baltimore, Maryland, and President, Total Child Health. Dr. Howard spoke at the 35th Annual Pediatrics for the Practitioner, presented by Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, Division of General Pediatrics and Division of Adolescent and Young Adult Medicine, the Johns Hopkins Children's Center, and by the Maryland Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Howard.
Hi, this is Dr. Barbara Howard, a developmental behavioral pediatrician, here to talk to you today about an important and very timely subject, and that is childhood anxiety. I am not talking about any unapproved or investigational products or devices during this talk. You may have been aware of a great increase in anxiety these days. This is not very surprising, given how anxious the adults are in this time of COVID. However, children are normally happy, and fear is also normal and protective. It's good to be afraid of things that are actually dangerous. It's a good adaptive trait. Temperament also varies by individual, and slow to warm up children, those who are hanging over by the window during the birthday party instead of playing with their peers, that temperamental characteristic tends to persist and predict to some kinds of anxiety, but not in every case. Normal children have rapid changes in their mood, including how fearful they are, but normal fears, like fears of thunderstorms, can also mimic and obscure actual anxiety disorders. Younger children are much more responsive to the environment and to stressors than older children who are more upset by more theoretical things. But starting by about age 6, and sometimes as young as age 3, children can be anxious because of the meaning of events to the child. For example, they know that they're going to be moving. Young children are oblivious to the impact of that in terms of loss of relationships with friends, for example, but older children are very aware of that and anxious about uncertainties. Too little anxiety can put a child in danger, for example, thinking it's okay to jump off the rooftop with their paper cape, but too much anxiety for normal things is also dysfunctional and has impact. So it's good to have a medium amount of anxiety for survival. Younger children actually have different symptoms of mood than older children. They may exhibit clinginess, they're slow to warm up, they may have trouble separating, but they don't always appear to have a specific anxiety type. They also are more likely to be irritable, hyperactive, aggressive, or have changes in their eating or sleeping as they're presenting signs of anxiety problems. Older children are more somatizing. They complain about aches and pains, belly aches, chest pain, leg and arm aches or headaches, and low energy. Sometimes they complain about being bored and show a lack of interest in social things, preferring instead to stay in and play video games. Watch out, because video games are pretty addicting. But they also may be rejected for their anxious symptoms. Interestingly enough, peers sometimes reject anxious children because it makes them feel uncomfortable and anxious themselves. Even older children may show their anxiety through procrastination, underachieving at school, or perfectionism. It turns out that ADHD-type symptoms are often due to anxiety. In fact, that's the most common mistaken diagnosis where ADHD is diagnosed instead. Keep in mind, though, that anxiety is also comorbid with anxiety. Anxiety disorders are genetically determined to some extent. It's much higher in twins and the offspring of anxious parents. I already mentioned the connection to temperamental behavioral inhibition, as it's called. That's the slow to warm up. But we also know that there are physiological differences with imbalance in norepinephrine creating fatigue, but imbalance in serotonin creating irritability and anxiety. There are even EEG differences, cortisol, and heart rate variability differences in anxiety, with a lower heart rate variability and higher heart rate in children who are more anxious. Some other causes of problems with anxiety include traumas or losses and anxious caregivers. And this may remind you about what you're seeing in the office these days. Kids tend to be as anxious as their parents are. And when parents are able to do a good job disguising anxiety from their kids, the kids feel much more secure. This actually points to some of the things we should be thinking about. So in this time of COVID, there's some things we can recommend to parents about how they talk to their children about COVID. COVID's a tough one because it's invisible, and yet the whole population seems to be frightened about it, as it is also, in some cases, life-threatening. So rather than wait for questions, because children aren't likely to do that, particularly they don't ask questions when they see that it makes their parents uncomfortable, it's important for parents or adults to bring it up and to ask the child what they know or have heard about COVID and how it makes them feel. This is a good time to think about turning off the television news. That may have something to do with the overall anxious sentiments in the United States. But the television news is always playing death counts and showing pictures of bereaved relatives. That's more than children should have to deal with. It gives them a general sense of dis-ease. Instead, it's good to keep it simple and positive. Tell them the truth and tell them that the adults are working on it. They appreciate knowing that someone's in charge who is responsible for helping with the problem. And you should also, though, validate their concerns rather than put them down. Don't say, there's nothing to worry about. Say, of course you're worried. We all have some worry, but here are the things that are being done about it, and here's some things you can do about it. Giving the child some tasks like washing their hands and remembering to wear a mask, give them control over the situation. They can even come up with their own ideas as they get older on action steps, like a sign that says, be sure to wash your hands. It's important to convey accurate information, not rumors, which make it even more anxiety-provoking when they get conflicting information. And to be compassionate to the altered behaviors that can be due to stress, such as clinginess, irritability, hyperactivity, and altered sleep. All of those can be problems for the parent, but rather than get angry about it, they should be understanding. Some of the other things that can help include maintaining routines and the usual discipline in the home to show that everything's actually normal now, and always demonstrate that you are an available and trustworthy source of information going forward. Now, if some of those things sound like good advice for adults and for our society, indeed they are, because these are universal things that help reduce anxiety. Let's talk about some of the diagnostic aspects of anxiety. I'm going to discuss one anxiety disorder, one of the several anxiety disorders, in more detail to let you know what the pattern of how diagnostic criteria play out. This is a combination of DSM-4 and DSM-5 diagnostic criteria. In DSM-4, excessive and persistent worry that occurs in many domains was the criteria. DSM-5 made that more specific to say on two or more criteria and more days than not. And then added in DSM-5 was for at least 3 months, three or more months, because normal fears to changes, for example, going off to daycare, typically last about 6 weeks or so, not 3 months. The child finding it difficult to control the worry was removed from DSM-5, mostly because it's so difficult to determine that. Instead, causing significant distress or impairment in functioning is always one of the criteria for a disorder. In the case of generalized anxiety disorder in DSM-5, it specified that there should be three or more of the following symptoms with at least one of A or B. That's restlessness or muscle tension. We'll get back to the importance of muscle tension in a little bit. But sleep disturbance, easy fatigue, difficulty concentrating, and irritability are among those characteristics that are counted. Now, when you look at those, restlessness, sleep disturbance, difficulty concentrating, and irritability, you can see why ADHD is often mistaken as the diagnosis instead of anxiety disorder. Other characteristics in the DSM-5 include at least one of the following behaviors: marked avoidance of activities, that might include going out with friends; marked time and effort preparing, this is often a kid taking too much time to get dressed in the morning; marked procrastination, this is more likely procrastinating on things like homework; and repeatedly seeking reassurance from adults beyond the typical age to do that. And then E, F, and G should look familiar because they're true for all DSM disorder diagnoses, that is significant distress or impairment in functioning. Notice it's distress and also impairment. You can have one or the other, but distress is often the more significant symptom in anxiety disorders, not due to substances or another medical condition and not better explained by another mental disorder. Generalized anxiety disorder in children tends to take the form of failure to achieve an expected level of functioning, but somatic complaints are common, and one of the most common characteristics when you talk to parents is that the child is constantly asking what-if questions. What if I throw up in the movie theater? What if you forget to pick me up at school? And this is actually a clue towards what parents need to do about these things also, and that is to be sure to answer them in a very boring and repetitive way to make sure that the child doesn't keep looking for a new and slightly changed answer from the parent as a sign that maybe they weren't telling you the whole story the first time. Cognitive distortions are very common in anxiety disorders, seeing things as scarier or more dangerous than they really are, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. Boys and girls are about equally affected until adolescence, and then it's more common in girls. And for generalized anxiety disorder, the prevalence is 2.7 to 4.6% of children. There are physical conditions that may look like anxiety, but as you'll see in a minute, these are mostly rare. Hypoglycemic episodes, hyperthyroidism, cardiac arrhythmias, caffeineism, not so rare. Keep an eye out for that. Lots of things have caffeine that you wouldn't expect. Pheochromocytoma, seizures, migraines, and central nervous system disorders are also rare. But asthma is not so rare, and asthma can affect children with anxiety in two different ways. One, the asthma itself is scary because you feel like you can't breathe, right? The other thing is the medicines we give for asthma sometimes cause symptoms as well. And keep in mind that medicines, both prescribed and over-the-counter, can be a cause of anxiety symptoms. You may have experienced some of this yourself from antihistamines, stimulants, caffeine, again, steroids, theophylline, phenobarbital, hypertensives, antihypertensives, atomoxetine, antipsychotics, SSRIs, which we're going to talk about in a minute, are also a treatment, and diet pills. I mentioned that there were a number of different types of anxiety disorder. You'll notice that obsessive compulsive disorder has actually been removed in the DSM-5 from the anxiety disorders. And these include generalized separation anxiety disorder, social phobia, specific phobias. That's the most common type, actually. Panic attacks, agoraphobia, that's fear of going out, substance-induced anxiety disorder, anxiety disorder attributed to another medical condition, or anxiety disorder, garbage can, NOS, not elsewhere classified in DSM-5. Altogether, when you take all these together, this actually is the most common set of childhood psychiatric disorders, affecting 12 to 20% of kids. And anxiety disorder is often the least well-identified and treated, mostly because it's subtle and doesn't cause a problem for the adults in many cases, like an externalizing behavior disorder. Now, anxiety disorders don't tend to run alone. They tend to run with another anxiety disorder. A third of kids meet criteria for two or more. But as I mentioned, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder also has a significant rate of children with anxiety disorders, also depressive disorders. And any serious medical condition can, of course, be connected to anxiety. But mitral valve prolapse is a particularly interesting one. It's associated with panic disorder, but that's actually a genetic connection, not due to the actual symptoms from mitral valve prolapse, which is basically asymptomatic. Substance abuse can cause you to be anxious, but it also can be self-treatment for anxiety. Eating disorders are also comorbid with anxiety. And let's not forget that anxiety can be a cause of suicide. So it's not just depression that causes suicide. Anxiety can cause suicide also. The natural course of anxiety disorders is, unfortunately, in many cases, to persist. So children who have criteria for one anxiety disorder, 42% will continue to have criteria for an anxiety disorder, maybe a different one, but an anxiety disorder at 21 years old. And if they had two, 77% continue to meet criteria. That makes early treatment particularly important. So let's talk about anxiety evaluation. As usual, a history is the most important, but anxiety histories can be limited because the children may not recognize their own impairment and they have a limited number of vocabulary words for anxiety symptoms. One of the questions that I've learned was very helpful for looking at impairment from the child's point of view is asking, what does your worry mess up for you? They understand that being anxious may mess up willingness to go on a play date, for example, or sleep overnight. And they may be able to give you that kind of history. Parents actually underreport internalizing symptoms of children, but they do tend to see the impairment because it impacts them. When the child is anxious about going out, then the whole family gets stuck and can't go out. So that kind of impairment will be reported. Be sure to take a developmental history looking at temperament, separation issues that go beyond the usual age, fears that are impairing, sleep, mood, and trauma experiences. The review of systems can look for those things we just talked about as symptoms: sleep, appetite, weight change, pain, change in skin, hair, or stools, as in hyperthyroidism or palpitations, and of course, functioning, thinking about school, and comorbid conditions such as ADHD, daycare, and peers. Asking about relationships with peers can uncover social anxiety, and also autism spectrum disorder, which has comorbid anxiety as well, and of course is increasingly common. Assessing the family is really important, looking for stressors, and also how the family deals with the anxiety symptoms by reinforcing it with accommodations that let the child off the hook. This is true in about 97% of families, and is a very important part of the treatment, is to help parents understand the problem with accommodating anxieties instead of helping the child get through them constructively. Of course, I said it's a genetic disorder, so looking for the family history of anxiety problems. Physical exam for those things I mentioned, and think about using a specific screener, not just initially, but also later to monitor symptoms. Here's some of the anxiety measures: the parent report, clinician rating scales, and self-report measures. As I mentioned, children aren't great at self-report, but some of these tools go down as low as age 6 and can be helpful also in helping the parent and the child appreciate what they're dealing with. Visual analog scales similar to the pain scale can also be helpful. Check out schoolpsychiatry.org to see these tools. It's also in the appendix. Let's talk about some general advice for what you can do to help children who have anxiety disorders. First of all, routines. Routines are very soothing for children. They make children feel as though life is safe and someone else is in charge to keep things orderly, especially routines that help them with the scariest parts of the day, like getting ready for school or getting ready for bed. Both of those transitions tend to be difficult. Saying the same reassuring phrases to the anxious child, as I mentioned before, helps them settle down and not continue to ask questions that ramp them up. And introducing children to only one new situation at a time if you can, helping them plan ahead for situations that may be unusual so they have a plan in case things get out of control. When big changes are inevitable, breaking them down into little pieces and asking the child which ones seem most worrisome, if possible, practice is important. But real anxiety disorder treatment, the best one, is cognitive behavioral therapy. Now, cognitive behavioral therapy has multiple components that you should look for when you're finding out whether a referral for a child is actually getting the child the right kind of treatment: demystification, relaxation, desensitization, self-talk, and problem solving, and relapse prevention. So I'll talk about those again in a moment. But remember that individual children may have special needs that need to be taken care of. So a child who's anxious because they have a learning disability and can't function in school might need a special education assistance, or a kid with poor social skills needs social skills assistance. Family training is really important. Sometimes this also means that anxious parents need to be treated for their own anxiety. And pharmacotherapy is not exactly a last resort, but not the first thing you should go to. Remember, the effectiveness of cognitive behavioral therapy causing remission for any anxiety diagnosis is 56% compared to 28% for controls. 56% is very similar to the effectiveness of many psychopharm medication assistants, or a kid with poor social skills needs social skills assistance. So let's talk about the components. Demystification is basically psychoeducation, helping the parents and the child understand that anxiety is natural and part of the flight or fight reaction to things that are perceived as scary, and helping the older child understand that no one's ever died from anxiety. It always goes away. Actually, it has a peak and flush out of the system with the adrenaline surge. It doesn't mean you're crazy. It's really something everybody has. And not sleeping at night or not eating for a day or other kinds of changes in routine won't kill you either. It's important to make sure the parents understand the importance of taking care of anxiety at earliest stages you can to avoid long-term complications that can become debilitating. Building coping skills includes desensitization by approaching the things the child is afraid of and reinforcing those for braver behavior. This should be done systematically in small steps, working from easy to hardest, giving the child some say, for example, on going to the next step so they have a sense of control, and making sure that you do this as soon as possible so that the feared situation doesn't become more of an anticipatory anxiety as well. You may have to plan for daily exposures to do this, one or two behaviors at a time with a reward occurring immediately after the desired behavior. These should be something small that can be given frequently and that are valuable to the child. I'm going to talk about marks in just a minute. Keeping a chart of this will be helpful too. Parents really need to buy into this. A very important part of treating anxiety is get back on the horse. That means don't allow early escape from a feared situation while anxiety is still high, or anxiety will actually get worse. Now, bravery marks, you may have heard me talk about before, is basically putting an ink mark on the child's hand each time they do something just a little bit braver than they might have otherwise, aiming for 6 to 10 marks per hour and rewarding the child for having a bunch of marks. Bonus can be given for extra outstanding bravery. This helps the child recognize their own progress and also helps the parent have something they can do. And building coping skills also includes learning relaxation. Remember, tension of the muscles is one of the prime characteristics. So abdominal belly breathing and working on progressive muscle relaxation is really valuable. Relaxations can help with this, so can mindfulness apps like the Calm app, concentrating on breathing, feeling the air going in and out. For younger children, any mental task requiring concentration can help, even coloring books or doing puzzles. As kids get older, kind of a self-hypnosis is visualization. So visualization means thinking about a situation that would make them feel calmer, encouraging them to think about the scene in great detail with sights, sounds, feelings, smells, and tastes, maybe even imagining a reassuring parent or friend to help out. That's a very good skill for people any age. And self-talk. Self-talk is basically taking the cognitive distortion of anxiety. Naming the feeling helps externalize it. So instead of calling it anxiety, call it Andrew and talk about Andrew's coming, but we've got to get ready for him so that he doesn't stop us from doing the fun things we want to do. It also emphasizes a distinction between the child and the problem and allows the parent to team up with the child against the anxiety rather than getting angry at the child. Now, some other parts of self-talk, more valuable as children get older, is to help the child sort out, is this a real fear about a real danger, or is it anxiety, or Andrew in this case? Things like asking, how likely is it that what I'm afraid of will actually happen, like I'll flunk the test after getting all A's up until now? What other explanations are there besides the one I'm worried about, that my friend doesn't like me anymore because she didn't answer my phone call? Even if the worst thing should happen, how bad would it be? How could I handle it? Is there anything I can do about the situation? If not, what can I do to take my mind off of it? Those are all good self-talk skills. Dr. Ginsberg, who was at Hopkins, talked about teaching children problem solving because all of life has problems in it, and how you cope with it can make the difference in how anxious you feel. Those are similar to what I just discussed, settling down your feelings, owning the problem and determining if it's your problem or someone else's, listing the solutions, voting for one, and then engaging in the solutions. There's a great book called Coping Cat, which is actually a manualized CBT program that I highly recommend you read if you're interested in this topic. You can do some of this yourself. When should you use medication for anxiety? You wonder why I leave this to the end of the talk, and that's because you should do those other things first. First of all, medication should be reserved for moderate or severe anxiety, making it easier for the child to face what is feared, because facing it is what actually helps, and blocking the most distressing physical symptom of anxiety, such as the tachycardia. It can also be helpful to treat comorbid conditions like ADHD that make the child more worried about not being able to control themselves or being a fool in school, and reducing the child's anxiety level in order to reduce its interference with day-to-day activities. This also reduces the consequences of prolonged or untreated anxiety problems. And we should remember that certain types of anxiety, OCD used to be called an anxiety disorder, but they respond particularly well to medication. It's also good when psychotherapy, or better yet, cognitive behavioral therapy, has not been completely successful. Adding medication can help get more successful. Those are the times you might think about using medication, and the best medication for anxiety in children is selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Anxiolytics should be reserved for only acute anxiety. It's been somewhat controversial, but it's become clear that Prozac, fluoxetine, actually has the best efficacy in children. Tricyclics do not work in children for anxiety. And remembering that except for Prozac, the SSRIs tend to have a shorter half-life in children, so the dose may need to be adjusted up once they tolerate a smaller dose. This is the drug of choice. Start low and go slow. Remember, it's well-tolerated. But after 4 weeks, if it's not significantly improved, the dose can be increased. And for anxiety, fluoxetine has efficacy for social phobia, separation anxiety, generalized anxiety disorder in randomized control trials at a rate of 79% compared to 30% placebo. Sertraline is also better than placebo for generalized anxiety disorder, as is duloxetine. These medications may need to be administered for quite a while. Remember the side effects. GI side effects are the most prominent, but the emergence of suicidal thinking is something to warn parents about, although don't say it in front of the kid because they will then be afraid of that themselves. But there have been no actual completed suicides. Hypomanic symptoms can also come from SSRIs, particularly if the child actually is headed for bipolar disorder. Remember that treatment generally takes months to work, not weeks. Thank you for your attention. I hope you'll join our free CME case discussions once a month, the third Tuesday of the month. I co-lead this with a developmental behavioral pediatrician and our own Emily Frosch from Hopkins, a child psychiatrist. Sign up at kgauthier@chattis.com to get on our list. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Barbara. I actually have a question for you. How do you suggest that parents partner with teachers in addressing some of these issues when the children with anxiety are at school?
That's an excellent question because, of course, in the old days, like last year, kids spent more time in school than they did interacting at home in many cases. And school tends to be a place where children are anxious because their expectations for performance, both academic performance and getting along with other children. So it's an anxiety-provoking situation. So the key thing is not to have teachers make things worse. Teachers can actually be a great adjunct if they understand that a kid has anxiety. One of the tricks that I sometimes recommend by having the clinician or the parent communicate with the teacher and come up with a secret signal. So a secret signal to the kid or the child have an opportunity to signal the teacher when they're feeling nervous about something. For example, they don't want to answer a question verbally. Many teachers will take that as an opportunity to pick on a kid, especially in older grades. So the teacher and the child have kind of a pact that they will answer when they have an answer available or will write something down for the teacher instead of being picked on by the teacher, which is how they feel.
Great. Thank you. One of the participants just wanted clarity about antihistamines, whether they can cause anxiety or can be a treatment for anxiety.
So it's the fact that antihistamines can make you feel anxious, so cause anxiety, that's important to recognize. And we all know that Benadryl can make you feel wired or tired, right? So It depends on the individual kid. Some children may actually feel calmer on antihistamines because they feel more lethargic. So that may be something that they consider to be a positive, but it was the side effect of being more anxious that I wanted to point out because people mostly don't recognize that that can happen.
Thanks. Here's another interesting question. Many anxious children have anxious parents. How do you take this into consideration when working with the family?
Well, that's exactly right. And that's generally the key to having good progress on anxiety is that the parents need to both recognize anxiety, recognize their own anxiety, try to quell their anxiety. Sometimes the treatment for the child can be also a good treatment for the parent. So the parent can attend cognitive behavioral therapy with the kid and learn those strategies along with the child. There are some wonderful books. My favorite is Freeing Your Child from Anxiety by Tamara Chansky, I think it is. Freeing Your Child from Anxiety, my favorite one, especially at the end where it gives lots of practical suggestions. And those are good things for parents to read together. So the big problem with persistent anxiety is when parents actually do what I mentioned as accommodation. So basically, they're either removing the child while they're anxious, which remember, it's the opposite of get back on the horse. They're taking the child away while still anxious. They actually are making the anxiety significantly worse. And they need to at least, at the very minimum, understand not to do that. The trouble is, it's making them anxious to see their kid anxious, or the same situation that's making the kid anxious is making them anxious. So when you put it all together, that's a bad cocktail. And work with the parents. And sometimes it's even important to refer the parents for therapy for their own anxiety in order to be successful in treating the child.
Great. Thank you. Another question. How do you work with parents who are not seeing results from the SSRI within 1 to 2 weeks?
Again, this may very well be an anxious parent. The fact that the parent is feeling anxious about the lack of progress in 1 or 2 weeks, even though you should have told them this is going to take about 4 weeks before we'll really notice much of a change. That usually reflects their anxiety. So giving them the other things to do so that they can stay active in helping their child, I think, is the best way to deal with that. And again, if you didn't hear the last part of my answer about sometimes parents needing to be referred for their own therapy for anxiety, that would be fitting into that same category.
Great. Here's another one. When starting an SSRI, how do you help children and parents not focus on small aches and pains and thinking these are significant side effects from the medication?
Well, that's a particular problem because, as I mentioned, especially in school-age kids, aches and pains may be one of the main symptoms of anxiety in the first place. So I think that some of the same kinds of objectification, making a chart perhaps, naming the aches and pains, and exercising yourself through the aches and pains can be very helpful. And many things can help with migraine and the comorbidity of migraine and anxiety. And that sort of general life healthiness, in particular exercise, can help people. I think it may be a gate mechanism. If you get up there and exercise hard enough so that you feel sore, you don't notice that you're experiencing the aches. So changing a somatic mindset can be pretty tricky. Interestingly enough, there's some cultural differences in how people perceive and express their mental health problems, including anxiety, and somatization is one of them. So find something else to do with your body is really important, besides the demystification, making sure they understand there's nothing really wrong with them, that the pains are real, but they're not dangerous. That's the key thing.
Great, thank you. This will be our last question. Can you discuss management of anxiety in college students who have tested positive for COVID while living on campus and subsequently are placed in isolation? Are there online or virtual therapists you would recommend who specifically have been trained to deal with COVID and anxiety-related disorders for college students?
Well, that's an excellent question. And I think at this point, any online therapist will understand that COVID isn't really different than other things that cause people anxiety, so that they don't need one who is a COVID-specific online therapist. Talkspace actually is available around the country. That would be one thing to think about. That's a service, an online therapy service that people could access from anywhere. It may be that the college health program actually has online therapists available. I wouldn't be surprised. Actually, I would be surprised if they don't. So that would be something to keep in mind. This is a very tricky thing because people understand that they might get sicker and sicker, and there they are by themselves in their dorm. Very, very difficult situation for college students. So I'm sympathetic about it. Sounds like it was a personal question for the person who asked. So I would definitely recommend staying in touch frequently during the day with that college student, as well as getting them therapy.
Thank you, Dr. Howard. For information about upcoming CME meetings presented by Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, visit hopkinscme.cloud-cme.com.